the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the real estate market has been powering on despite the various crises that we've seen in the market, whether it's Brexit or worries about economic growth at the beginning of the year. Real estate in the U.S. is booming. Joining me on the program is Rick Sharga. He's Executive Vice President of 10X. And Rick, let's begin with your overall assessment of the real estate market. We've had some pockets of weakness, but yet we continue to see the market continues to power higher. Home builders are doing good, but we have some choke points in various parts of the United States. Give me your overall assessment of real estate.
I'm probably slightly less bullish than you are. I do think that the market is still in recovery. We went through the most volatile boom and bust cycle in the history of the housing market back in the mid-2000s. And we dug a hole so deep that almost anything looks like improvement from there. But we're continuing to move in the right direction. And the number of existing home sales, the number of new home sales, continue to move in the right direction, despite the fact that there are a number of pretty significant headwinds that keep the recovery from really being a bit more bullish.
And could you name what those headwinds are? Because, I mean, if we look at mortgage rates, last week we set records for a U.S. 30-year Treasury auction. Likewise, in Germany, they auction off a 10-year note at a negative interest rate. So what would be the headwinds? It certainly, I don't think, would be mortgage rates, would it?
No, I think you categorized it perfectly. Mortgage rates are the least of our problems right now. In fact, I have to laugh when people talk about the potential negative implications of mortgage rates going up by a point over the course of a year. And I'm thinking, so a 30-year fixed rate will now be 4.5%. And you and I probably both have enough gray hair to remember when mortgage rates were in double digits, and that didn't affect the home sales terribly much. So no, mortgage rates are not the problem. Mortgage availability is a problem. It's still probably twice as difficult for the average borrower to qualify for a loan as it was during the pre-boom era when things were operating normally. Banks simply aren't taking on any risk, and non-bank lenders are not quite as circumspect, but they're still making it a little bit difficult for those borrowers. Borrowers on the margins or who are more challenging in terms of credit records or work history are having a just impossible time getting loans. So loan availability is one of the headwinds. Another, and I think we're going to probably talk about this a little later, is the lack of availability of inventory. We're seeing very, very low levels of inventory in existing homes for a number of reasons. And new homes, even though we're seeing a little bit of construction coming back, the inventory available of new homes is at almost a 40-year low. So there's just not that much to buy, which drives prices up, which makes affordability the third issue, even though, you know, you wouldn't expect that with mortgage rates being as low as they are. But Jim, you know that the third leg of the affordability stool, we talk about home prices, we talk about mortgage rate, the third leg of that stool is wages. And the middle class today is making less adjusted for inflation than they were 8 years ago, which makes rising home prices a problem for that category of potential home buyer.
Let's talk about this headwind you talked about. Lenders are less likely to make loans, or it's tougher to get a loan today. Rick, how much of that had to do with Dodd-Frank in terms of all the regulations that have been placed on banks? I mean, there has been just a plethora of regulations coming out of Washington. How much of that is basically coming from regulations, and how much of it is just maybe some caution on the part of banks since this economic recovery has been so anemic?
That's a great question. Historically, every time we've gone through one of these boom and bust cycles, and again, none were quite as volatile as this last one, we've seen lenders go from being a little overly lax to being overly conservative. So part of this is kind of a normal correction. But I think the unintended consequences of the Dodd-Frank regulations, specifically some of the regulations put in place by the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, have had a devastating effect on people's ability to get a loan. Probably the biggest single culprit is the ability to repay rule, which by itself made it virtually impossible for between 30 and 40% of African American and Hispanic borrowers to even qualify for a loan. And it made it very challenging for first-time home buyers, millennials, who are coming out of college with large student debt. And that debt impacts their debt-to-income ratio. So they're getting lower paying jobs than they anticipated, coming out with a large amount of student debt. it's just going to take them longer to get their debt-to-income ratio in line with what these new regulations require. So again, I think that the CFPB had two almost mutually exclusive goals. They were to make loans available and safe. I think they've done a remarkable job on the safe side, but it's almost impossible to do both of those things equally well. And I think they probably overshot a little bit on the safe side compared to the available side.
Let's talk about something that may be a headwind, and that's building supply. The Wall Street Journal recently did an article that said building permit delays choke U.S. housing supply. In the study shows that in certain states, the permitting process can take as much as almost a year, places like New York, California, and they mentioned that a lot of builders, let's say you're a large builder, you're going to build a large tract of homes, 200 homes, and it's going to take you a year to get that permitted. You don't know what the economic environment is going to be like a year or a year and a half from now.
Yeah, it is contributing to the headwind. So we talked a couple of minutes ago about a lack of available inventory. On the existing home side, one of the biggest issues has been that we still have a few million homeowners who are underwater on their loans. And according to a Zillow report, there are a larger number than that who are at near negative equity. So you have millions and millions of homeowners who might normally be putting their homes on the market who simply can't afford to do that right now. And that has a strangling effect on existing home inventory. On the new home front, construction is lagging, and the permitting issue is one of the contributing factors to the fact that we're seeing not as many new homes start construction or in construction as we need to meet the growing supply. It is particularly problematic in an area like California where you actually do have demand and there's simply not enough inventory to go around. But when you're looking at a predictable cycle time of 6 to 9 months for permitting, and you might have another 6 to 9 months on top of that to get zoning variances put in place as a builder, that makes it really challenging for builders, particularly in a market where capital is difficult to come by. If you're going to build, you're typically tying up capital for the length of time from permitting all the way through the ultimate sale of the property. And capital just isn't quite that patient in a market that is really still licking its wounds from the last downturn.
When we take a look at the housing market, I wonder if we can get specific here. There's been various articles in the Wall Street Journal, for example, in my own state of California, where starter homes can be on the market in less than a week and get snapped up right away. And then you have the homes in the upper end market, let's say $1 million plus market, that can remain on the market for long periods of time and sell at less than listing price. Are you finding that generally to be the case around the country, or is it more specific to markets that have really grown in price, as we've seen here in California and other areas of the country? Is this a general characteristic of the market right now, or is it specific to a particular market?
What we're seeing is that the trend of very little entry-level housing stock is pervasive. It goes across the country. Builders aren't building that kind of stock in large numbers, partly because of the permitting issue we just talked about, partly because recent regulations that have entered the marketplace have added anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 to the cost of building these new homes. So it's tough to sell a property at a low price point. But there is very limited entry-level inventory. When it comes to the market, it goes very, very quickly. This is part of the reason why the first-time home buyer contingent only makes up about 30% of any month's sales, whereas in a normal, healthier market, it's closer to 40%. The problem is exacerbated in some of the hotter markets in places like coastal California, the Pacific Northwest, markets like Austin, certain parts of Florida, which are coming back very strongly. So it is a national problem, but it is a problem that's particularly difficult in some of the markets that have recovered most rapidly.
When we take a look at these particular markets, I want to get into, let's say, the retirement market. You have a lot of baby boomers, 10,000 of us a day moving into retirement. A lot of these boomers are selling the bigger homes that they started the family with. The kids have all grown, gone to college, they're often married, and they're downsizing. Do you find any markets that are very hot right now due to, let's say, affordability? Because I know I have had clients sell their homes here in California, move to Arizona, Texas, and elsewhere, where the cost of housing is so much cheaper than high-priced markets like California.
I haven't seen any reports or any specific research that we've done that shows a flight out of California by retired boomers. But I can tell you that the two states that have shown up most strongly in our research from our 10X research team in terms of retiree housing are Arizona and Florida. Florida still, at least according to our research, is sort of the king of the hill when it comes to retirement housing. And what we are seeing is a pretty interesting metamorphosis in terms of retirement housing. It used to be pretty much that, you know, you would either downsize and live in a much smaller home, an apartment probably, than what you had lived in, or you'd move in with family, or you'd go to a retirement home. And what we're seeing now is a plethora of choices. One of the areas of growth that we are seeing in home building in California, for example, is 55-plus communities. So for the boomers that aren't quite ready to retire, still living active lifestyles, we're seeing that specific type of housing. You're also seeing different stages of retirement housing coming to the market where it's, you know, more and more services and support as population ages. But they kind of bridge that gap from living on your own to moving into a nursing home that didn't really exist before. And I think the aging of the boomers is really driving a lot of that kind of inventory.
What about new kinds of services that are out there? And I'm thinking of Airbnb. It was either the Journal or Barron's did an article about some people that have retired. They need the extra income. They don't want to go to a reverse mortgage. And so some retired couples are actually turning into landlords, renting out part of their house to tenants.
Yeah, we've seen two things along those lines. One is that the number of single family homes that have become rental units has gone from 12 million back in 2009, 2010 to about 16 million today, and will probably continue. Now, some of that was driven by large institutional investors gobbling up vacant homes and turning them into rental properties. But some of it is people doing exactly what you just described and turning the properties into cash flow. Some things we're seeing in terms of Airbnb, but there are some pockets of the country, notably areas like New York and San Francisco, that have recently enacted legislation to make that a bit problematic. There are kind of entrenched interests and tax issues that I think the Airbnb crowd is starting to bump into, and it'll be interesting to see if that slows down the juggernaut or if Airbnb overcomes those obstacles and continues to grow.
So if you're looking at this real estate market, on the positive side, we have mortgage rates that could remain low for a longer period of time. In fact, we may even see new record low mortgage rates given what's happened in the bond market. That's very positive for the market. But headwinds, we have stagnant wages, we have a limited supply and tougher lending standards. You know, that seems to me that there are more negatives, at least, than positives. So if you were assessing the real estate market, what would you be doing right now? If you're a first-time home buyer, would you be looking at buying? Are there still attractive places where there's bargains?
Oh, yeah, there are a lot of bargains out there. You and I both have our vision skewed a little bit by the fact that we live in Southern California, where bargain is definitely a relative term. But if you're in a state like California, you have to look at secondary and tertiary markets, and there are buying opportunities in markets like that. We're seeing a lot of buying going on in the Southwest, where home prices are definitely more affordable. So the affordability wall that we've hit is in the higher price markets. It's in the Bay Area of California, Southern California, Austin, parts of Texas, parts of New York, but only parts of New York. So there are a lot of buying opportunities out there. And the truth is that the market has been doing what a number of us anyway predicted would do after the bust. It's been recovering steadily, but very slowly in sort of a sawtooth manner. It goes up a little bit, it goes down a little bit. And I don't think we'll get back to a full recovery, which would be, you know, home price appreciation stabilizing at 3 to 4% a year and between 6 and 7 million units being sold between existing homes and new homes until 2018 at the earliest. Again, there's too many headwinds that are keeping the recovery from picking up a full head of steam. But having said that, we've also been in a period where household formation has been relatively weak. We have an historically large percentage of young adults living at home with their parents. The good news is that a lot of them are now playing Pokemon Go instead of Xbox, so they're at least outside, and they might see other houses and maybe decide to buy one someday. But as household formation does increase, obviously the number of potential buyers will increase, and as home prices go up, We believe that'll become a stimulant for people to ultimately put their homes on the market. So we're still in recovery. I don't think it's a fragile housing market. I just think it's kind of pulling itself through the slog on its way to a very, very long and painful recovery.
Rick, what about another element that has bolstered real estate prices here in the U.S.? I'm thinking of foreign buyers. If you take a look at negative interest rates in Germany and negative interest rates in Japan, some of the instability that we have in Europe and elsewhere, doesn't that make the U.S. a very attractive destination for foreign investors?
Yeah, this is the ultimate good news, bad news scenario for U.S. real estate. In volatile times, like you've just described, we have seen the U.S. real estate market really appeal to international capital as people are looking for a safe haven and a place to put their funds. So we saw it when Greece was going through its crisis. We saw it when the Eurozone was having a meltdown. We certainly saw it when the Chinese economy began to slow. And I believe we'll see it again as we watch Europe work its way through the Brexit issues. And yes, we saw over $100 billion just in residential purchases last year from international buyers. We saw a similar number in commercial sales purchases, and I think it's very likely that we'll see that number increase this year. China has become a major, major player. For many years, Canada had the highest number of international buyers buying U.S. homes. China right now is buying more homes than the next four countries combined, and three times more than Canadians, who are the second largest cohort. So it's good news because it keeps the market going. It keeps sales activity strong. It's bad news if you happen to be a first-time home buyer and are competing with people that are paying all cash and not worried about slightly overpaying because what they're trying to do is protect their capital.
Let's take another category of investor that helped in the recovery, especially in the early stages, which were investors. I can remember in 2009 and 2010, Rick, where there was a large contingent of hedge funds that were raising money that were going into places like Vegas and Florida and buying large swaths of housing tracts and basically hiring managers, turning them around, renting them, and then flipping them. What about the investor today? You know, money is earning nothing. You're getting nothing in a CD or a bank, and you're looking for a rate of return. What about rental properties? What do they look like?
Rental properties are a very attractive option for real estate investors today. What's been fascinating is this was probably the best kept investing secret that everybody knew about. When I mentioned that there were 12 million single family homes being rented out in 2009, 95% of those were owned by investors who owned five or fewer of those homes. So it really was the purview of the small individual, you know, mom and pop type investor. The institutions got involved when there was a glut of foreclosure inventory available. And just recently we saw that Blackstone announced it's going to do an IPO of its Innovation Homes business, which consists of 50,000 of those rental homes that they purchased and have subsequently rented out. What's been interesting over the last couple of years is the institutions have slowed down on their buying and the individual investors come back into the market and started to buy that inventory. We see a lot of it in our auction.com business unit, which sells properties at foreclosure sales and then sells bank-owned properties as well. A huge percentage of the people that buy those properties are buying them to hold and rent as cash flow units. So I think for an investor who knows what he or she is doing, taking a piece of available real estate and turning it into a rental unit, particularly in markets like the Midwest and Southeast, where those properties are affordable, and you can rent them out at an affordable rate, but still turn a profit, it's going to be an ongoing opportunity. And that's particularly true since home ownership rates are as low as they've been in the last 30 or 40 years, and most people don't project them to come roaring back anytime soon. So lots of rental opportunity in the near term for investors.
And Rick, is there any place in the country, in your estimation, that stands out more as a bargain? I know after the financial crisis, those areas that were overbuilt, where you're looking at Phoenix or you're looking at Florida and even parts of California or Vegas, were great bargains. What about the Midwest and other areas where, let's say, your money is going to buy more house and your cash flow is going to be much better because you're buying more house for less money?
Yeah, we have an investor who lives in California and buys a lot of properties from us and buys them exclusively in the Detroit area.
Detroit?
It's not necessarily in downtown Detroit, but in the Detroit metro area. And his model is he'll buy a property for $40,000 or $50,000, spend another $20,000 or so fixing it up, and then rent it for $900 to $1,000 a month, you know, which is a remarkable cash-on-cash return if you start multiplying that by a number of properties. So there are areas in Michigan and Ohio and Indiana and Pennsylvania that the price has dropped pretty significantly. You can buy a property at really below market value, fix it up, and still be able to turn a nice profit on that property as a rental unit. Interestingly, two of the hardest hit areas in the country during the foreclosure crisis were Las Vegas and most of Florida. And while prices have come back in both of those markets, and we actually look at Florida as one of the hottest markets in terms of growth potential, even Florida is still about 50% off of its peak prices. So there is some headroom, even in some of the places that were overbuilt and overpriced and hammered during the foreclosure crisis that aren't, you know, somewhere off in the Midwest that you've never heard of.
So if you were looking at the markets right now, and let's take three types of investors, somebody that is looking to retire, sell their house and maybe downsize, or let's say a young couple starting out in life, an investor, your advice?
My first advice is don't listen to anybody you're hearing over the radio.
Okay, guys, anybody listening to this program, just turn it off.
No, everybody's situation is very, very different, and that's why I have a hard time answering questions like that, although it's a fair question. You know, what's interesting is we are seeing millennials buying properties and renting them out rather than buying properties and moving into them. So they're still renting themselves or maybe living with family, but they're buying properties as rentals. And I guess my advice for people at both ends of that spectrum would be to take a look at the best opportunity in your local market, because you're probably not an experienced investor. You probably don't want to be trying to manage property halfway across the country. So, you know, it will vary. I would tell either a young couple or an older couple, if they happen to be living in coastal California, that there are probably more fix and flip opportunities out here than there are buy and rent opportunities, simply because inventory is so low and people are willing to bid and pay top dollar for a property. So it really comes down to what your comfort level is. If you're looking for ongoing cash flow, or if you're looking for a one-time profit, what you feel good about in terms of being able to see the property that you're managing, or you're comfortable having somebody manage it for you at a distance. There's so many variables that go into that, Jim, that I just hesitate to give anybody particular advice.
Well, listen, Rick, if our listeners like to follow your work and find out more about real estate, how could they do so?
They can visit 10x.com. It's TEN-X.com. We have a blog that we publish an awful lot of real estate information on. They can follow me on Twitter if they'd like. It's simply at Rick Sharga, RickSharga, or come find me on LinkedIn and send me an invitation to join up, and I post things on LinkedIn pretty regularly as well.
As always, thanks for joining us on the program. All the best, sir, and come back and talk to us again.
Be happy to. It's always a pleasure, Jim.
Well, some interesting comments coming from Rick Sharga as we began that discussion. We talked about mortgage rates are at historic low levels, may even head lower, which is a positive element for the real estate market. But he talked about some headwinds. Banks are tougher on borrowers today for good reason. They had to be. Look at all the losses they took in the financial crisis. And then the other headwind is building supplies. A lot of that has to do with not only conservatism on the part of home builders, but also, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, bureaucratic red tape today can take as much as a year. Having gone through building a home myself, it took us almost a year just to get through the permitting process, so I understand that one very well. That's placing a limit on supplies. And then finally, in this economy, wages have been stagnating. As Rick talked about, middle-class people are making less today in real terms than they were 8 years ago, and you're seeing that reflected in this year's presidential campaign. But as Rick said, this real estate market still has a ways to go. And if you're looking for income, if you're an income investor and know what you're doing, you can get a better yield probably in the real estate market than you can in a bank or even government bonds today. Well, on behalf of John Leffler and myself, as usual, we've run out of time, but we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You've You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.